Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're going to jump back into this compelling conversation with General David Petraeus. In part one, he explained the current position in Ukraine and the woeful execution both strategically and tactically under Putin's leadership and what might follow. In this second part, we're going to discuss China, Iran, cybercrime, the weaponization of the dollar, and how businesses rethink their own supply lines, and more. Well, before we travel east in a minute, let's just pause on NATO, if I may. I think the US has, in aggregate, financially and materials, provided essentially two-thirds relative to Europe's one-third. How would you like to see NATO evolve?
Well, I think endless numbers of presidents, secretaries of defense, military commanders in the US have hoped that NATO countries, in Europe in particular, would do what to some degree is being done now. Germany, which was not even at 1.5% of GDP being spent on defense, all of a sudden rockets to 2% and even has a $110 billion equivalent for readiness, and also for the first time ever provides lethal equipment to another country, etc. So you're seeing real dramatic change. But at the end of the day, still, as you noted, in fact, it's even more than you noted, because the U.S. doesn't just spend more than all of its 29 NATO allies put together right now, soon to be 31. It spends more than 2.3 or 4-ish times as much. That is a vast gulf. And yes, our economy is vastly greater, but again, there should be even more defense spending by Europe, by NATO countries. And, you know, a number of them, France in particular, puts forward the notion that we should be determining our own defense priorities and capabilities. Okay, yeah, let's see it. Do it. But don't reorganize what you have now and create a new headquarters to oversee them. How many additional battalions of either infantry, cyber, space, you name it, whatever it is. But it means new capabilities, not just new concepts or theories. Now, again, to be fair, I don't think NATO unity has been what it is now since the end of the Cold War. And I was also at one point in time the speechwriter for the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe. And I remember how it was during the Intermediate Nuclear Force Agreement period, and the unity was just extraordinary. The wall came down, the USSR collapsed, dissolved, Warsaw Pact fell apart. A number of those countries started moving into NATO eventually. But NATO was in search for a reason to live, if you will. And no one has done more to make NATO great again than Vladimir Putin, ironically, even though he was setting out to make Russia great again. And of course, pushing Finland and Sweden into seeking accession to NATO is very, very important geostrategically. The Baltic becomes a NATO lake now, et cetera, et cetera. And when you look at the Arctic and so forth, which is a new battlefield of the future, if you will, or at least a field of competition in the future, very, very significant action. So what he's done to reunify NATO, to give it, again, this reason to live, a real serious mission, has been extraordinary. But we would like to see more done nonetheless.
So I think you've nicely encapsulated the Euro situation, the wider European situation. But let's talk about China. It's been described by, as the chronic challenge. Others would say asserting its own view of its rightful place in history. How do you think the competing political philosophies can coexist?
What there have to be is essentially an agreement on here's where we're going to work together, here's where we're going to compete. here are the, if you will, the rules of the road so that the competition doesn't turn into conflict. And recognizing that that would be completely unthinkable, really. It has to be unthinkable. And our efforts to ensure deterrence, keeping in mind that deterrence is a function of two elements. It's a potential adversary's perception of your capabilities on the one hand, and we have to transform those, as I mentioned earlier, to make sure that they are credible. And then your willingness to employ them on the other hand, there can be no doubt about that. And so we have to keep that in mind all the time. I do believe that the current U.S. administration is doing that, even though I very much disagreed on the decision to withdraw from Afghanistan and then the execution of that decision, which I felt had global repercussions, as do many other leaders around the world. I remember, in fact, one time when we had the red line that wasn't a red line, as it turned out, in Syria, the prime minister of a very important country in Southeast Asia said, you know, General, that stuff reverberates out here. And when it comes to this very important component of the potential adversary's perception of your will, that calls that will into question. Now, for better or for worse, the response led by the U.S., very impressive, to the Russian invasion in Ukraine, I think has pushed that into the rearview mirror and shown that U.S. leadership is not only absolutely vital and necessary, but it can actually be deployed in a very impressive manner. But we have to recognize there are different ideologies, there are different approaches to governance, economics, social activity, and so forth. But what we've got to do is make sure that what is termed a severe competition by the U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, who's an understated guy and a brilliant guy, severe competition cannot turn into conflict. And we have to ensure that, despite the different objectives of the two sides when it comes to certain issues in particular.
And might there be a possibility that in thinking about this new bipolar world that will sort of reemerge, but with China on the other side from the US and NATO, that Xi Jinping maybe is overestimating his own invincibility and layering on top of that the extraordinary, and you'll be very familiar with it, but the World Economic Forum, I think, has essentially the Chinese population going from 1.3 billion to not much more than 600 million by the end of the century. It's a shrunken state. How do you think about that?
Well, China faces a number of challenges. The question I think a lot of us are asking, keep in mind that I'm the chairman of a global institute for one of the world's biggest investment firms. We've raised the biggest funds in history of any firm, specifically for Asia, I think now two or three consecutive times. So we are very keenly focused on issues out in Asia, including in China. And the question, I think, is can President Xi and his inner circle, but especially he, because he is now an unprecedented third-term president, perhaps more terms, perhaps president for life. And of course, actually, the really important position is the party leader, because that's what he was reelected to do and then goes with that as the chairman of the military commission. And then actually, it's not until a few months from now, I think, that they'll gather and actually reelect him as the president of the country. But the important question is China a learning organization? Because at least from an outside perspective, one can ask, was zero COVID a wise domestic policy? Well, they've actually thrown it over. And of course, there's enormous repercussions of that. I mean, the deaths, of which are very proud that there were, you know, very, very small numbers. But the price of that policy in the absence of an mRNA vaccine and very high rates of vaccination with the elderly in particular, in the absence of that, it was predictable that the death rate would skyrocket, and it will. And I think it ultimately will surpass that of the United States, which has lost well over a million U.S. citizens to COVID. They reversed that. And again, I think the right decision, albeit, if you will, a very, very difficult one, given how much that was embraced and how unyielding the approach was to zero COVID. Can that be applied to, you know, if you look at some of the other activities from, again, an outside perspective, and keep in mind that that's not the perspective. There's this different, and it has to do with party dynamics and, if you will, domestic politics there. Is Wolf Warrior diplomacy a constructive, positive approach for them? Well, perhaps domestically, but it's caused the EU to shelve the investment agreement. It's caused a number of other countries to respond to that as well. Is beating up Indian soldiers on the line of actual control, killing them actually, is that productive to the very important relationship with the country that's going to pass China, if it hasn't already, when it comes to the largest population in the world and one that's growing very rapidly. Economic coercion against countries like Australia because they asked to investigate the origins of a pandemic that was killing at that time hundreds of thousands of people around the world, now millions. The physical intimidation on the high seas, does this help the average Chinese citizen? The question is, can they come to the realization that perhaps it might not be? Noting, again, there are other dynamics which drove China to these policies and to their implementation. But if such a significant policy as zero COVID can be reversed, could there be reversal of some of these others? And then could it be sufficiently sincere that we could all just have a more, at least constructive, at least somewhat more mutually beneficial relationship, even as there is, again, a continuation in some respects of severe competition and domestic practices, if you will, when it comes to surveillance state and other issues that are at odds very much from what we believe is the right course.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come, but a quick pause. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, chief executive of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine, and as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold, and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business, and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by Livetrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. Livetrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy, and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, Bordeaux Index/Livetrade. The Money Maze podcast is also brought to you by our final sponsor, Mintus. The world of art investing has been typically out of reach for most investors, and yet returns have been very impressive. Mintus is a new concept in art investing, giving investors a chance to own the unownable through an FCA-authorized and regulated fractionalization platform, which offers access to iconic and rare paintings from contemporary art masters like Warhol, Kondo, Francis Bacon and Basquiat. Actual paintings, not digital assets. For investors seeking to diversify their portfolios through an asset class historically uncorrelated with stock market investing and with strong returns, we've been impressed with Mintus and think it merits a closer look. So let's turn to another country who couldn't be further away from Western values, and that's Iran. We had Sebag Montefiore, as I said, who described them as this evil regime. Major General Mick Ryan, who you'll know is commander of Australian Defence College, described it recently as a repulsive regime. And yet, rather extraordinary, at least here in the UK, bodies like the BBC are remarkably calm and uncritical of this regime that is carrying out untold horrors and where there may or may not be the beginnings of another revolution. What's the long-term game plan from the West vis-a-vis Iran?
Well, that's a very tricky issue because for the US, UK, other Western powers to actively be involved almost hands the regime a stick with which to beat us, or at least to beat their people, because then they will say, you are just puppets for the Americans, the Brits, are acting in their direction with their assistance and so forth. So I think that is the challenge that all Western nations face when it comes to determining how can we help those who are protesting against this repulsive, murderous regime, keeping in mind that hundreds of our soldiers were killed in Iraq from these explosively formed penetrators that were provided by the Revolutionary Guards Quds Force of Iran to the Shia militias of Iraq before we defeated them in the Battle of Basra and Sadr City and so forth in 2008, keeping in mind that, of course, what they're trying to do in Iraq and also in Syria is to achieve what they achieved in Lebanon, to Lebanonize Iraq, if you will. So in other words, to have control of very powerful militias on the street. So you have street muscle, and then you have control of a sufficient block in the parliament that you can veto anything that you don't like, as again, they have achieved in Beirut. And that's very, very worrisome. again, what they're doing to their people is just so far beyond the pale. I'm hard pressed to say that you're going to see the regime overthrown anytime soon, even though there are some very, very impressive scholars. Karim Sajapour is one in the U.S. who has said, you know, this regime is going to go down. And he is a very thoughtful, informed, incisive individual on the issue of Iran. And he's finally starting to get convinced that this regime is not going to survive. The problem is, of course, is it short term, mid term, long term? I mean, we all eventually, all regimes and all people ultimately will die. But the question is, how soon? And I have been a tiny bit skeptical because what you have are people who are on the side of the demonstrators, unarmed, largely unorganized. I mean, that's one of their strengths, is that there's no key leadership that can be decapitated and end the regime the way it happened in the past, where they put this individual in jail or house arrest and the movement withers on the vine. And they're not necessarily keen to die. They are taking enormous risks. Some of them are being killed, but they're not out just to purely be martyrs in this cause. They're up against a regime that has massive forces. I mean, just the besieged militia alone is over 2 million thugs, basically, who can do everything with wheeled pipes on the street to weapons, who are very organized, highly equipped, and are willing to kill. So the question is, when might these regime forces, the besieged militia, the Revolutionary Guards Corps, Quds Force, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, which of course is in addition to the normal regular Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and the other elements of the inner circle, when might they step back, as did the Egyptian army when Mubarak ended up in front of the bus, and say, we're not going to kill our own people, and we're just no longer going to be party to this? And say the oil workers go on strike as they did back in the final days of the Shah. This kind of indicator is just not there yet. It's not impossible that it could emerge, but the regime is so substantial. And it's not a case where if the supreme leader goes down, they can all step back and retain their positions under the next leader, the way the Egyptian army did with Mubarak. They might go down as well. So that's the problem here. And as I said, the challenge for U.S. and Western countries is, how can you support them, perhaps covertly, clandestinely, without being exposed? How meaningful can that be, actually? Because you can't do it overtly without playing into their hands and making this into a struggle of the West versus Iran, which provides a rallying cry for the regime, almost a lifeline for the regime.
Yeah, well, that's very clear. I'd like to ask a couple of financial-related questions. In the war against Ukraine, the U.S. authorities decided essentially to weaponize the dollar, froze Russian assets, which was perhaps unexpected by the Russians, which, of course, will have had other regimes thinking about dollar assets. Doesn't that actually undercut what former French President Giscard d'Estaing described as the exorbitant privilege that the US enjoyed, courtesy of the dollar? Doesn't it undermine the dollar over the medium to long term because other competing blocs feel less inclined to have as much in dollars because they've seen what can happen?
Well, having taught economics back in the day, as well as international relations and some other subjects, but especially as an economics professor, I learned you can never go wrong by saying it depends. And it does depend in this case. It depends on, are there any alternatives that truly are as attractive, as stable, as dependable? And the answer to that, I think, is not really. So you might see a tactical shift a little bit more in, I don't know, the euro, the pound, the whatever it might, even maybe a tiny bit in the renminbi or something like that. But there's no sign, I don't think, of true displacement of the dollar as the currency through which much of trade is done. What's ironic, of course, is that other countries, some adversaries, and even corrupt individuals all rush to get their assets into the dollar because you actually have rule of law, transparency, and all the other qualities that give you confidence that you can actually invest in it or in commodities, whatever, securities, assets, equities, you name it, real estate, in that dollar, and it's going to turn out better than it would in other currencies. And so the irony is that Russia, thinking that it was going to sanction-proof itself, stashed $600 billion around the world including $200 billion in China. And then every country froze those, including China, by the way. And China, for all of the declarations of partnership without limits that were made prior to the opening ceremony of the Beijing Olympics, as you'll recall, at the beginning of the last year, even China has not unfrozen their reserves, has not violated export controls in any meaningful way that we're aware of, and really has not been a partnership without limits. There have been limits, even as they are very happy to exploit the moment and get yet further advantageous deals on natural gas or oil or what have you from Russia at Russia's moment of weakness.
So as a former economics student, I have now taken some notes from a former economics professor. Thank you. I want to just go back to cyber crime. You just alluded to it in an earlier conversation, and I was chatting to Rob Rooney, he's a friend of the show and the former chief executive of Morgan Stanley in Europe, and he said, essentially, do you believe that the major players are acting in a similar way to mutually assured destruction in the Cold War because they have the capability to shut down enemies' critical infrastructure and financial systems, but won't press the button?
That's the theory. Again, I think it's a theory to which the major powers, in a sense, should ascribe, whether or not it is true, if you will. Again, I think that we have certain capabilities. I know we have certain capabilities. I think we have others. We don't know until we actually try it. This is not, candidly, quite as precise as, say, an intercontinental ballistic missile with a nuclear warhead on it, the yield of which we know and the target of which we know. And if it goes through, we can literally predict the casualties, the collateral damage, and all the rest of that. Cyber is much more ephemeral. In fact, one of the challenges that we have is we have declared that there is a new battlefield domain, cyberspace. So, you know, you had ground, then you had sea, and you had air. There's the subsea part of the maritime, and then there's outer space is yet another new domain, and cyberspace has been added. But how do you deal with cyberspace? This is not quite a geographic combatant command the way that, say, Central Command was when I commanded at the Greater Middle East. It's just there. It's how do you grasp this? How do you conceptualize it? So that's their area of responsibility. How do you even draw lines? How do you divide authorities? Who's the main effort? Are they the supported command or the supporting command? These are very esoteric, very sort of philosophical, except that this is what you have to come to grips with when you are conducting operations. And again, we know there are certain capabilities because we've actually used them. We've also prevented the enemy from using others. The reality is we do fear certain actions, certain capabilities. They fear certain actions and capabilities. And it does have somewhat of a deterrent effect, I believe, but no one would really know until they try it out. And by the way, let me point out that there was a huge fear that Russia would completely shut down Ukraine, would completely disable their telecommunications, their access to the internet, their communications ability, and they threw everything at Ukraine and it didn't succeed. Yes, there were disruptions. Yes, there were various issues, but Ukraine had gotten better in cyberspace and cybersecurity, cyber resilience as well. And there's an open source. Microsoft actually put out a study. It was actually introduced by Brad Smith, the president. It's available on the internet that lays out the magnitude of what Russia did. And it was very, very substantial. And it didn't work. Now, it was a close run affair in certain respects. Civilian industry, particularly Microsoft, because it's so ubiquitous in certain areas, played a massive role in this. But the fact is that Ukraine got much better. The U.S. finally has gotten much better. Your National Cybersecurity Center was way ahead of ours. It was a model for what eventually has been built, Security and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA. We're still building capacity and capability and additional authorities and appropriations and so forth. But it's getting better here, finally. It took us too long to make Cyber Command a full-fledged combatant command, too long to have CISA brought into existence and built up. But that has happened. And by the way, again, we learned a lot. I visited the center headquarters in London and was hugely impressed. But all of that now does change the dynamics. And of course, there's a constant, if you will, cat and mouse between offense and defense in cyberspace. And of course, the offensive actor only has to succeed once. It's a little bit like counterinsurgency. the insurgent only has to penetrate one place. You have to protect everything. And that's true in cyberspace as well. And I think the reality is that we now recognize that every individual entity that has something that's really important has to have a designed, comprehensive, integrated, managed cybersecurity solution based on zero trust principles. Zero trust meaning that with one single password, you can't have free reign of the entire system. It has to be compartmented. And you have to constantly update this. The management piece of this is very, very substantial. By the way, this takes about roughly 85 discrete capabilities, if you will, applications. I'm on the board of the largest pure play cybersecurity services firm in the world, Optiv, which KKR owns. And we also have a number of other investments in many, many other cybersecurity firms and capabilities. So this is very, very complex stuff. And then it has to be augmented by the really, really big idea, which is sharing real time of information about threats and mitigation measures. And that's where we still are not where we need to be. That's where, frankly, Congress in the U.S. has been reluctant, for understandable reasons, to compel companies to immediately alert, say, CISA or some other organization. It takes hours, sometimes days. You've got to operate at machine speed, not at telephone or individual alert speed. And that's something we're working on. That's a huge conceptual issue because there are fiduciary issues in here as well. It can have effects on stock prices, et cetera, et cetera. So that's something that we still have to resolve. Again, to be fair, the UK is ahead of us in this. The scale is more manageable. The authorities of a parliamentary system can be a bit more easy to manage and so forth, and pass off to the cybersecurity center there, which also has an advantage that we can't replicate, which is about half the people are from GCHQ, your version of NSA. For us, NSA is an outward looking, it's a foreign intelligence agency, not a domestic spying agency. And so there are limits to how much NSA can do in that regard as well. And that's a big advantage for your cybersecurity center.
And when we think about business risk and interruption, you chair the KKR Global Institute. What is it that clients and businesses with whom you interact most want to ask you and where you think you can most help them?
You know, it starts actually with just really imparting a recognition of the biggest of the big ideas about geopolitics. And that is that just in the time that I've been at KKR, which is approaching 10 years now, we've gone from an era of benign globalization in which economics determined geopolitics. And geopolitical risk was something you did when you invested in a country the first time and didn't have an office there. The first time we went into Vietnam or to the Philippines, the former Yugoslavia, Mexico, Chile, Colombia, Africa, you name it. And we evolved from that to a world of renewed great power rivalries where geopolitics now determines what's possible economically and in terms of investment and trade. It circumscribes, it constrains the context in which all of this takes place. Just for starters, that is a massively big idea. If you can come to grips with that, then you start to get into the more micro elements. And now you get into how do you apply that to specific relationships, specific regions, specific countries, and ultimately to specific industries, and then ultimately specific investment opportunities. And then there's a host of legal issues here, especially from a U.S. perspective, the entities lists in which you cannot invest, the dual-use technology areas that you can't get into, concerns about data and data flows, concerns about, again, the surveillance state activities, will that contribute? All of this, and these are growing. And when you have the United States that puts the kind of restrictions on the export of advanced microchips, the fabrication machines, the plants, and so forth that are used to make them, and the intellectual property that underpins all of it, which happens to be U.S., even though the most advanced are made, of course, in Taiwan and in Korea, with machines made in Netherlands and Germany, but all based on US IP, that is a very, very substantial restriction. And if that grows a bit more, and I think our sense is that there will be additional restrictions, but it will be higher fences around fewer items rather than many, many items surrounded by less high fences. So now you can understand what we as investors, we own about 120 companies around the world, which in many cases own other companies. And then we have minority investments in well over 100 additional. Now you get a sense of what they have to grapple with, how transformed the environment in which we're all operating together has been over the last decade, and what the implications of that are for specific investments in specific companies, specific industrial areas, specific countries, specific regions.
That's very helpful. And we actually had Philip Fries of KKR, who runs the PE activities in Europe, on the show a few months ago, and that was very insightful.
Brilliant guy. And so, see, again, for his perspective, overseeing, again, the private equity investments in Europe, really in EMEA, again, because it's also Mideast and Africa. But from his perspective, many of the investments that we did in the past in, say, the advanced Western European countries didn't really worry about geopolitics that much. They certainly do now, because they have exposure not just to Russia and Ukraine, but also to China and also to a number of other countries, where, again, in an era of benign globalization, you weren't worried. In an era of renewed great power rivalries, you have to be very worried. And I should just note that after 2014, we examined our European portfolio. So what is our exposure to Russia and Ukraine? Because we've never invested directly in companies in Russia and Ukraine, but we have very substantial customers and actually numbers of workers, thousands in each country, especially those that are working remotely in the IT sector, given the skills in cyber and so forth in both those countries. And then we revisited that back in 2020, when it started to appear that it might be possible that Russia would do what it has done, and then put in place mitigating measures. Okay, you want to stay in Kharkiv, second largest city in Ukraine, right next to the border in eastern Ukraine with Russia. Well, okay, and you're reluctant to move, I got it, but at least pack your car with everything but your toothbrush. The minute something happens, take the toothbrush, get in the car, and drive to a location that you've already arranged that someone can't snatch out from underneath you, and from which you can continue to do your job, ideally, if that is possible. So again, there was quite a flurry, needless to say, both within Russia and in Ukraine when it came to helping these individuals who are part of companies that we own or in which we are invested. But those contingency plans very much paid off.
Got it. Well, that was that business continuity planning that I think in the early days, many of us wondered whether money was being well spent. And recent events have absolutely shown that to be essential.
But of course, until it does, people think, gosh, can't we cut this cost? I mean, really, do we actually need to? But of course, that is ultimately proved itself very valuable. By the way, so has stockpiling of supplies and raw materials and components when it comes to various manufacturing endeavors in which we used to practice just-in-time logistics. Just-in-time logistics no longer works in an era of pandemics, in an area when entire regions of the biggest manufacturing country in the world are shut down, in an area of disruption of shipping and various other supply chain elements. Unfortunately, we've gone from just-in-time logistics to just-in-case logistics again, which means that you're back in the business of warehouses and iron mountains and lots of, again, the various elements that are required for an individual manufacturing company to do what it does. And we've learned that you can't put all of your manufacturing and assembly in one location, because if it's shut down, then you're in big trouble. So you're also now seeing diversification of those when it comes to, for example, East Asia. You're seeing a migration in some cases from China, Vietnam, to India, to other Southeast Asian countries, Philippines, and so forth. None of which obviously has the capacity of China right now, but India in particular is building it. And then you also see the impact of the rising labor costs in China over the years as well. And then you see the rise of the robots, which means that you can actually bring something back to the United States, do that task without people. So labor costs aren't as big an issue as they were. And you can reshore, or at least friendshore, if you go to, say, Mexico or Canada. These dynamics also are part and parcel of what we examine, in that case, together with our global macroeconomics analysis team and our environmental social governance issues team as well.
Very important advice for people working in conditions that are becoming more challenging. Now, I'm going to move to some closing questions. I've heard your dog bark, so I know that somebody's impatient for me to get off this call, but I'm not quite going to let you go. But questions which we always ask, if you could have dinner with one or two people unrelated to you, alive or dead, who would they be?
What's interesting, I was asked this question by the New York Times, of all things, about 5 years ago. And I said, you know, I'd like to sit down with General Ulysses S. Grant. When it comes to the United States, in a lot of ways, he's the Wellington of the U.S. He is the only U.S. Army general to have performed brilliantly at all three levels of war. So the tactical level, which is sort of multiple brigades, say division command, this would be, I don't know, 10,000 people. Then operational level, multiple divisions. He's promoted. Now he's got multiple divisions underneath him for the Battle of Vicksburg, one of the greatest operational maneuver, high-risk battles in history, not just U.S. history, but all history of warfare. Magnificent. His trusted Lieutenant Sherman writes a letter and puts it in the official file. This is his closest comrade. And it says, essentially, I want the officially known that I think this is too high risk. And yet he pulls it off and he takes Vicksburg, which severs the Confederacy, and it opens the Mississippi River to the Union. Then Lincoln recognizes his brilliance. He brings Meath through Chattanooga, Battle Above the Clouds, which is also brilliant at the operational level. And then he's made the overall commanding general of the Union forces. He designs for the first time a comprehensive strategic approach, which in essence makes him the man who saved the Union, because that strategy won the victories that enabled Lincoln's reelection. You know, a lot of people just think that it was axiomatic that Lincoln would be reelected in 1864. It was not at all. The North was very concerned about the continuation of the war, the massive casualties, the lack of progress. And there were draft riots in New York City. There were splinters between clubs in New York City. This is when the Union League Club broke out of the Union Club, which refused to expel Robert E. Lee from its membership. And the Union League Club to support the war effort while others were opposing it. So again, he could have lost. And the individual who would have beat him, McClellan, twice had the overall command and failed, ironically. And yet the possibility was there that he could defeat Lincoln and he would sue for peace and just let the South go. And we would not have the Union that we have today. So it is accurate, as the title of one of the books by Professor Brands, which says, the man who saved the Union. And so in a sense, therefore, truly unique. And I just happened to be reading Grant Takes Command, a classic work by Bruce Catton, during the surge in Iraq. And I found it hugely inspirational. The sheer determination in the face of all of the challenges. And I don't want to equate Iraq to the U.S. Civil War, but for the commander, there were a lot of similarities. You know, you have tough casualties. You got Congress breathing down your neck. You got the White House asking, hey, when are we going to win the war? You got journalists all over you, more than a few critical voices, host nation partners that are imperfect, very, very challenging. And his approach, his genius to see a battle or an entire strategy unfold in time and space, and then convey directions to his subordinate leaders, his physical courage, and again, just this indomitable will, truly extraordinary, captured maybe best by his worst battle, which is Shiloh. They did prevail. They owned the field and the Confederate leader was killed, but they were almost driven back into the Tennessee River on the first day. They were surprised. Sherman, they're literally sort of clinging to the bank as Grant is getting reinforcements by ship brought down the river to enable them to attack the next day. He's standing under a tree. All of the available shelter is being used as makeshift field hospitals. He can hear the cry of those whose limbs are being hacked off by the surgeons. There's others who are still out on the battlefield, wounded, crying out to be recovered. And Sherman comes out of the dark and he says, well, Grant, we had the devil's own day today, didn't we? And Grant takes a stub of a cigar out of his mouth and says, yep, lick him tomorrow, though. And this just captures the kind of, again, sheer determination that is required of a commander. So what makes a great battlefield commander doesn't necessarily imply greatness as a strategic leader. And again, if you look at Grant, those four tasks that, remember when we started, of get the big ideas right, get the strategy right, communicate it effectively, oversee the implementation, and determine how to refine them to do it again and again and again. Grant was flawless at that while in uniform. Yes, there were some shortcomings. Yes, there were issues with alcohol, to which Lincoln responded, find out what he drinks, give it to the other generals, at least he fights. And yes, in his presidency, there were corruption issues and some others, misplaced trust. But as the man who saved the Union, that's someone I wanted to sit down with. Now, the irony would be that he was famously a man of few words, and I'd have to coax them out of him over time. That's the answer that I would want to give you on that one, which is somewhat shameless. But for your listeners, your viewers, I was a fellow at Harvard for 6 years, non-resident, part-time kind of thing. I've always had various academic things going on since leaving government. And in this one, we built a website on strategic leadership that describes these four tasks, goes into detail about the subtasks. You might actually put a link to it. If you go to the belfercenter.org, Harvard's Belfer Center, and Graham Allison, the great professor, was the head of it at the time, and then Google Petraeus on strategic leadership, it'll pop up. And if you can't find it, let me know and I'll shoot you the link. But it lays it out, and I found this to be a very, very valuable intellectual construct. And trying to perform those tasks discreetly, and it's not just in uniform, it's very much in the business community. I have a wonderful case in there I recount of Netflix with Reed Hastings, who I think one of the great strategic leaders of our time, up there with the Jeff Bezoses and Jack Ma's and others. And then also the case of Kodak, where they had 2,000 patents on digital photography, but failed in that fourth task to make the new big idea digital rather than film. And they've never been the same company that they were.
That's very interesting. And it's a slide that I use sometimes about the greatest consumer goods company not to exist today because of missteps. Two final questions, and one which I'm going to put in the reverse order following from what you just said. Are there any circumstances that could tempt you to enter into U.S. politics?
Not politics. I stopped voting when I was promoted to 2 stars, I guess inspired by the actions of General George C. Marshall, the architect of victory, as he sometimes described, during World War II, the most trusted military figure in the eyes of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and I think Churchill as well, frankly. And it served me in good stead because there were periods where there was a suspicion that I was going to run for president. You know, I was, quote, a celebrity general. That's not a term of endearment in the White House. But nonetheless, they kept calling on me. And I have clung to that. I firmly believe that the military, not only while in uniform, obviously should stay out of politics, nonpartisan, not bipartisan, but nonpartisan. But even in retirement, I think it's very unhelpful to those who are still in uniform for retired generals to be on stage promoting a particular candidate. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have views on policies, but those policies should be divorced from party politics and from individual political figures and should be rather the result of, you know, a reasoned, hopefully objective, rational approach that you then try to communicate, doing so in a constructive and respectful manner as is possible. And you've heard that here, right? You know, I think this administration has done a very impressive job with respect to the response to the unprovoked, brutal Russian invasion of Ukraine, and frankly, also in crafting a comprehensive, integrated whole of governments, S on the end, all of our allies and partners together in responding to the challenge of China and to the U.S. and Western relationship with China, while also noting that I, again, believed when the policy was announced that we would withdraw first the decision by the previous administration on the agreement with the Taliban and then to implement it by this administration, that we would come to regret that decision and that the outcome would be tragic, heartbreaking, and as it has been, I think, disastrous. But that's not party politics. Again, I've not yet even begun to register to vote, much less actually vote or support or contribute to additional. And I do advise candidates and those who are in government of either party. And frankly, at a time when there is a degree of partisanship on Capitol Hill, especially in our lower house, I think it's actually helpful if you are not identified with one or the other parties, because each party can actually seek your advice without being concerned that they're getting the view of one or the other party. So no, I couldn't be tempted to enter politics in that regard.
Very clear. So that's a great place, I think, for me to let you go. I'm going to two more things. I'd like a shout out to Johnny Gray, who was, of course, commanding the Argyles in Iraq. And it's courtesy of him. He's a partner now at Ankura, the advisory firm. It's courtesy of him that I've had the chance to talk to you today. So thank you, Johnny.
My appreciation once again to him for what he did back in the day.
Great. And secondly, this is a little family promo. My wife runs a podcast called Bandwidth Conversations. She interviews rock stars of life, and she has just interviewed Damian Lewis, who you remember was Band of Brothers and Homeland, and it's absolutely cracking. And I have to say, I know my place in the family now. She spent an hour and a half with him in a really interesting conversation. So there'll be competition between the best Brewer family podcasts in January.
As that song used to say, it must be cold there in my shadow.
I know my place. And interestingly, I know Andrew Roberts. So the fact that you are writing this book together perhaps means that we can do something in the future when the book is out.
Andrew is absolutely brilliant, incredibly productive, unbelievable, actually. And also delightful.
Yes. So two pieces of advice. We always take some advice from the show. My goodness me, I've written down quite a lot of points. One particular one, I love the way you express this when people worry about barriers because of the bipolar world. You say it, higher fences around fewer items. And I thought that was very nicely expressed.
And again, that is in essence how we characterize what the administration is doing when it comes to essentially export controls. And that's a very important concept because, again, given the magnitude, the significance of export controls on the most advanced chips, in other words, the smallest, this is where smaller is better, the most advanced IP and the most advanced manufacturing fabrication plant equipment, if that were to spread everywhere, of course, you would see massive decoupling between the US and China. That we don't think is the case. And keep in mind, by the way, you know, we didn't mention these ideas that we are in a Cold War or entering a Cold War or whatever. Well, again, we are in a severe competition, to use the term of our national security advisor, without question. But the Cold War has implications that just aren't found here. The contextual circumstances of the Cold War, where the US and the West had very little trade, commerce, economic exchange with the USSR and even the Warsaw Pact. And so that, as a metaphor or an example, it falls apart on that, though I understand what people are trying to convey when using it. But again, there should be an asterisk at the end of Cold War, noting that we and China are each other's top three trading partners. And it's only because of the North American Free Trade Act Part 2, US-Mexico-Canada Agreement now, that this united North American economy that we have Canada and Mexico as our top two trading partners, but China's right behind, occasionally actually nips up above one of those others. You cannot decouple. There is selective decoupling. That's the big idea here, not complete decoupling.
And for people who are interested in cyber, you've said Microsoft's Brad Smith has actually published a report on the Russian cyber activities in Ukraine, and we'll put that as a link on the show notes. So, although I could have gone on for much, much longer, General David Petraeus, I can only say thank you so much. I think our listeners are going to just be thrilled to have the chance to hear your perspectives on so many things. So thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure to be with you, Simon. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.